Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello.
Come on, Dan. Let's be real. We're not that fan base. It's funny because I saw it. Go for it.
I guess we'll go with a happy played beyond expectations in both tournaments week.
Happy gravy day.
Happy gravy day. Hope you all choked down some gravy, which is gross.
And Crowther's drinking gravy. Yes. I have to say that this fan base impressed me a ton during the tournament, and especially right afterward. I mean, myself included, far from the most rational fan around. I was oddly at ease at the end of that game. I think a lot of fans were. I talked to folks when I was at the women's game watching party in Houston on Sunday, and honestly couldn't find a more energetic and positive crowd. It was refreshing for a fan base that I feel like is ready to jump off a cliff at a moment's notice.
Yeah, I was sort of the same way. I think the way obviously both tournaments, in retrospect, you couldn't have asked for more, honestly. And the way both teams bowed out, I think, was decent in terms of, you know, mitigating any heartbreak. Like, neither game was all that close at the end, but neither team gave up. Like, Syracuse had, the men had that nice run to take it to 7 with, 6 minutes left that, you know, it looked like we were still competitive late in the second half, but then, you know, it looked like we were going to lose, and we all kind of came to grips with that before the finish. And then the women, obviously, you know, they lost by 31. That's like losing by 7 to a normal team. And even they had that 16-0 run in the middle of the second half, which was awesome. Like, they actually, I wouldn't say UConn fans were, like, nervous, but for a while, like, UConn just couldn't figure out Syracuse for, like, a good 3 or 4 minutes. And you can't say that about many teams against the UConn women. So it was a good effort. I thought Syracuse, you know, I wouldn't say they proved they, like, belong to the court with the Huskies, but I don't think there's a team that does. So they look like any other second or third tier women's college basketball team that plays UConn, which, you know, that's, we're striving to get to that, like, Notre Dame, South Carolina level next, and that's about what happens when those teams play UConn most of the time, too. So I think both teams avoided, like, a total disaster. They were both competitive against much superior opponents, and they both reached heights that no one thought they would 3 weeks ago, so... Very, very successful March Madness for both sides, especially the women, which is just an awesome achievement by them. I was tweeting a lot about it last night, but everyone seemed to handle it well, too, like you said. I thought the fan base was pretty great. Obviously, there were some complaints about fouls here and there and you know, anything else that there's always complaints about, but it seemed like everyone was really rational and kind of was happy about where things ended up for the most part.
Yeah, and I mean, like you said, it's the teams played far, far beyond... I think what folks thought they were capable of, and I think that, especially for the women, this is something that really changes the face of the program. It does for the men, too, and I think that's something we can discuss here, is, like, I guess starting with the men, like, this was the first season that Syracuse truly came out of nowhere to make the Final Four. I know in years past, you know, they might not have been a favored team. They might not have been... You know, somebody that you would have banked on to be able to beat some top seeds, looking at the 96 team, looking at, you know, 2013 team. But even then, those were not teams that, like, you know, those were teams that people weren't banking on, but they were not teams that were devoid of stars or devoid of talent or devoid of some sort of, you know, praise at one point or another in the season. I mean, this one wasn't either, but I think that this kind of allowed, I mean, we're not there yet, but this was a Final Four trip that allowed this program to kind of elevate itself and its level of play and its perception beyond narrative and beyond the kind of maybe tired view of them as a step below or a couple steps below the Blue Bloods. Because, you know, what the Blue Bloods have been able to do is make the Final Four not just when they're great, but when they're just very good and they just know how to play in the tournament, their coaches know how to coach in the tournament. And I think that this is, you know, I know we said it last week, and I've said it on the site, like, this might be Jim Boeheim's best coaching job of all time with, it, I mean, from what he said, his favorite team of all time.
Yeah, I mean, I think going maybe a week into the tournament, or even right before, we said, I know I talked about with people, how so often Syracuse men's teams have really finished on just in rough patches, even in tournaments where they weren't expected to go very far. Like, it seems like we're always have some awful way to bow out, whether it's the Marquette disaster, the over and back call, or the Butler fiasco, or the charge on Brandon Trish against Michigan, or AO and Fab's issues, and the Ohio State game, which remains like the most painful game to watch ever. There were always, like, even if the team went far, it was never just like they lost. There was always just some like event that sparked the loss that was always brutal. This year, I mean, the last time I think the team just kind of made it to where they were supposed to go and lost was 08-09. Even that was like a blowout game, like a really bad one. But this team, like, so far exceeded expectations, put up a decent fight against a one seed, beat, you know, obviously a bunch of teams that were not great. And then Virginia, a team that's been a major hurdle for SU since they entered the ACC. I think they just checked off a lot of boxes. And I think everyone has a really, assuming we figure out this roster in the next couple of months, I think everyone has a really good feeling about this program heading forward, which, you know, if this was another bad year, if we had missed the tournament again, I mean, that's two straight. You have Boeheim on his last, you know, couple of years here. You have recruiting questions, things that have been really ugly. Even with a tournament, you know, if they had lost the first or second game of the tournament, things could have been ugly for SU. And instead, I think the fan base is very excited and galvanized, and it seems like the team is pretty happy with how things went, and they're prepping for big things next year, which is always fun.
I would agree. I think, you know, you hit the nail on the head there in terms of just kind of maybe turning the page on a lot of these sanctions and things. I mean, obviously we're kind of hemorrhaging players right now, but I think there's two ways to look at it. And it's something that you and I were discussing with folks on the site and things like that, you know, is that there's, you know, way number one, which is these guys weren't going to play anyway. And then there's way number two, which is, yeah, but depth. And I think the yeah, but depth note is one worth bringing up, and one worth, you know, getting a little uneasy about, just because from the semblance of, like, even if we replace these guys, it's going to be with short-term fixes. For the most part, you're probably going to look at a grad transfer or two. I'm not going to say that it's bad. I'm not going to say the program's screwed, far from it, but I wouldn't just bank on this team being able to, you know, sit back and just be okay, especially when we don't know, you know, if anyone else leaves, and that's still very much a real possibility.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this hinges on what Malachi does, what, I mean, Leiden can always change his mind and enter the draft and then get shocked with some big news from the people there, or the draft combine. There are a lot of moving parts. I think from where we are now, I'm not all that concerned, because just based on how these things work out, I bet you that Boeheim knew Caleb and Chino were leaving in January, if not earlier. So I'm going to assume the whole staff has been aware of the situation with those two, and has been planning whether, you know, when these kids decide to grad transfer, both in and out, like, there aren't surprises. Coaches know who's leaving from other schools. So whether it's Grant Mullins from Columbia or someone else who hasn't made an announcement yet, or someone we don't know we're connected to, I have a pretty good feeling that Syracuse has its feelers out for a number of fits, especially at guard. I agree with you, like, the depth is a concern. Most more with Caleb. I think Chino, if he was going to see the floor, he would have seen the floor this year instead of Leiden all those times at center. But, you know, he just couldn't do it. And that's not, you know, it's not a knock on him. Obviously, he did us a real solid by graduating in 3 years, and himself getting an SU degree, especially after the NCAA decided that you, like, who knows what their judgment of his academics were heading in. But he graduated a pretty, you know, good private university in 3 years, something neither of us did. So that's all credit to Chino, and that's very good for our APR. I'm sure Caleb was in fine form as well, so that won't be a big issue. I wouldn't have minded keeping Caleb on the roster just because, you know, we've seen him have moments before, especially last year. And I still wasn't totally ready to give up on him, but I have no, you know, judgment towards him for wanting to go somewhere else after just totally falling out of the rotation this season and getting jumped by Frank Howard. So hopefully we'll find out some good news with one of these transfers coming up in the next couple weeks. And then if they strike out, if no one else is added, then I'm all aboard, you know, the kind of worry about death train, because then it is an issue.
Right. And yeah, you know, I really don't blame either of those players for leaving. I don't think it's a, I don't think it's necessarily a surprise. I mean, you've said, others have said, there's no way Boeheim didn't know. And I believe that wholeheartedly. And that's why you started seeing Syracuse start to gain some momentum with other recruits, you know, with a guy like Mullins. I think that SU's been preparing for this. I think what, no matter what, though, what you can't always prepare for is, you know, four guys and five guys leaving every year. And it's something I tried to kind of talk about in an article on Tuesday. Didn't seem like everybody was on board necessarily, but that was before we knew about Chino. I'd say that we'll be okay if this is the end of it, and maybe even if one more happens. I just think that unless you're going to recruit like Kentucky, you can't have player turnover the way Kentucky does every year.
And Kentucky's built on, like, assuming that people are leaving. Like, last year when a bunch of people stayed heading into last season, it was taken, I mean, it was a pretty big surprise when a couple of those guys held on, Willie Cauley signed, etc. But they planned for it ahead of time. Now, you know, who knows what Boeheim thought about, like, Malachi's pro prospects heading into the year. He's a five-star recruit, so you have to. And obviously Bam was high enough on him to, you know, bring him in and make him a starter from day one. So you assume that he understands there's at least a good chance that he heads to the NBA after a year. Obviously that's yet to be seen. But it's almost easier to, like, when you're recruiting with the explicit intent for these kids to leave right away, like Calipari does versus and what Duke does now at this point, versus what SU does, which is bringing in a lot of good players who, you know, are kind of on the, you never quite know if they're going to blow up and leave after 1 year or if they're going to end up being here for three. It makes it kind of tricky. So hopefully, like I said before, Boeheim has his contingencies in order. I trust that he does, but at the same time, you never know when something falls through. A couple months ago, it seemed like Torian Thompson was like a cinch to come to SU, and now it sounds like he's leaning in other directions, although he's been pretty quiet about things. So maybe with a couple of people leaving, he sees more playing time opening up and reconsiders us more heavily. It's all over the place. I mean, recruiting is such an inexact science, especially looking out from the outside, that you don't quite know what's going to happen until someone signs. So we have some fun intrigue to fill ourselves with the next couple months instead of just having a long wait without much news until football. So at least that's fun. It'll be good for the site.
Yeah, is there a time when Syracuse athletics isn't at least a little bit interesting? I mean, I know that that's coming from us as folks who are, you know, living and breathing and writing about it every day, but does it feel like there's always just more going on with us? I can't remember the last time we had, you know, like a quieter, maybe even couple weeks, even during the off season. It just seems like there's always something good, bad, or indifferent happening that you could write about, can write about, and talk about ad nauseum. Is that, Dan, you think that's a testament to the team's fans? Is it a testament to the stature of the program? Or is it just because it's been a very busy few years?
Probably all of the above. I mean, we've kind of had... Syracuse basketball's been kind of in a weird spot the last couple of years. We have had number one teams like three times in the last, what, 6 or 7 years. We've had NCAA stuff that seemingly lasted forever. We've had, you know, self-imposed bans. We've had five-star recruits, one-and-dones. We've had, all kinds of transfers. So it's been the last couple of years have been filled with activity, both good and bad. Two Final Four runs. So, yeah, we definitely have probably more going on than the average program. Obviously, we're way closer to Syracuse than we are other ones, so we don't know, like, the exact ins and outs of some of these other programs, but it definitely feels that way.
Yeah, and you know what? I like you said, we're in for another, you know, busy off season here. I am very, very intrigued about, you know, how Syracuse is going to be able to you know, replace these players and fill these roster spots. I mean, I was telling a buddy of mine today, like, which would have been nice if, you know, we were able to, you know, use all the scholarships, you know, whenever we want, as far as the five left, because we're, I'd say, probably going to end up having three available, if I had to bet, in this coming year. And that's going to be kind of frustrating in some ways, because while we could be over and done with those penalties maybe a year early, instead we're going to have to kind of suffer through whether we have the players or the scholarships or not.
Right. So, I mean, I don't know. I feel like it wouldn't be very Syracuse of this program just to have the team it has and move on without some last-minute changes and adjustments. So maybe we should be happy. Maybe we should be appreciative of how interesting and constantly evolving our program is.
I agree. I think it's better than not being talked about at all. I mean, you look at, there's plenty of programs that literally no one cares about on a day-to-day or hour-to-hour or year-to-year basis. Virginia Tech in our conference, Florida State more.
Who has also lost two players to transfer in the last 2 days. So what's up, guys? Virginia Tech?
It's a buzz. What's going on down there? Get a little, get a case of the, get a case of the frights looking around the conference.
I saw on Twitter today, a comedian and occasional, I guess he hosts a radio show, Jay Moore, compared Buzz Williams to John Wooden, which is maybe the weirdest thing anyone's ever said in the world, in history.
False.
No one's ever made a worse comparison.
That's, I don't know. How
and Buzz is a good coach, but come on. Like,
what was the basis for it?
I don't know. He must have just had him on the show or something. Yeah. Like, it was so absurd. I actually like clicked on it multiple times to see if it was like actually Jay Moore.
Like, we all have our dreams.
So that was, yeah, that was a thing on the internet today. Everything on Twitter is true.
Everything on Twitter. I mean, just go to any West Virginia blogger's account and you'll find a bevy of true information about your team's fate in a conference you're not currently in.
Yes. Shout out to West Virginia today. Got Will Greer. Going down the country roads.
To be honest, I think that's a good move for them. I think that Will Greer, it makes sense that he would want to leave. I think that West Virginia's done a really nice job with kind of rebirthing some kids' careers in recent years. Quarterback, I don't think that this is a sustainable strategy for them long-term, especially when they're a program that did develop a decent amount of homegrown talent. But, I think that this is not the worst way, if you're a Hulgo, to kind of set yourself up to win 7 games, 8 games a year.
Yeah, I mean, I would have taken them. Like, unless you are really hung up on whatever, like, weird over-the-counter, whatever the hell he was taking, weight gainers or whatever. Like, I'm not all that concerned about that. So, yeah, West Virginia definitely needs a little bit of infusion of talent. They've kind of admired in the endless abyss at the middle of the Big 12. So, why not pick up a quarterback who won 6 straight games to start the year last year, including beating Ole Miss?
Too true. Right, going a little over to the women's side of things, I know you and I were kind of starting to hit on this earlier. Dan, what does this mean to the program, making the Final Four? I mean, the score doesn't matter. The loss to UConn doesn't matter. You could have lost to anyone. But what does it mean for Coach Q to have been able to get this team, you know, full of talent and some four-year stars and things like that? How does it impact the future of this program's recruiting and its trajectory long term?
It's huge. I mean, obviously, you have to follow it up with continued success. Although, with the recruiting that Q's had over the last couple of years, I don't think that should be a major question. It should only get better. But I think it's huge. First off, I've literally have never seen the women's program have anywhere near the hype it had in the last couple weeks. And obviously, you can accuse Syracuse fans of bandwagoning and being, you know, just only supportive when they made this deep run. And who cares? Like, the program had such little fan support going into the tournament and basically throughout its entire history here. that what else are you going to do? So I think, A, we'll really find out next year when the women's team starts its season again, but I would be surprised if there wasn't at least a decent bump in terms of attendance and in terms of media coverage. I don't remember Syracuse.com ever writing so much about the women's team, but then they made their run and they were getting, not this coverage of the men were getting, but a very good, decent amount. Bud wrote his column about them, which was probably, what, the first time in 2 or 3 years. So just all, in terms of everything at home, it was only good. I saw, you know, so many people, everyone on Syracuse Twitter watching the game last night, a lot of statuses on Facebook from people who I went to school with, and I can tell you, as someone who went to, you know, probably a dozen women's basketball games while I was there, definitely didn't go to many, if any. So definitely, there's definitely an increase in engagement and interest. And then just in terms of making the Final Four itself, there just aren't that many teams that have done that. The women's basketball, obviously, the top tier is just UConn. They're alone at the top right now until someone decides to knock them off. But Syracuse did, I mean, it beat some big-name programs along the way. Tennessee is one of the historic programs in the sport, and they crushed them. They beat South Carolina, who's probably been the second-best women's program, maybe third if you put Notre Dame ahead of them over the last 2 or 3 years. So Syracuse involved itself into that category with, you know, the Tennessees, the South Carolinas, Notre Dames, the Stanfords, some of these other programs that, you know, they're not UConn, but they are kind of fighting right below them to be in the top 10 and to be the other number one seeds. That's huge because at one point, you know, UConn kind of came, like, UConn wasn't always the superpower in women's college basketball. They emerged around when their men did in the 90s, and they took the throne from Tennessee, and now they are kind of sitting there at top, and they've done things that no one else did before, but they won't be there forever. I mean, Gino can only coach for so much longer. He's not, like, about to retire or anything, as far as I know, but eventually someone is going to replace UConn at the top. It might take 10 years, but if Syracuse can just keep on helping, along with other programs, chip away at that solid number one team and make things more competitive and close that gap, I think it'd be great. And if you can finally get a couple thousand people in the dome for games, no one's asking for 20, but if you can get 5,000, 6,000, 10,000 for a big game into the dome, then that actually becomes a recruiting tool, and Coach Q can really go out and get even more of these top players. He's already signing top 10, top 15 classes. Now you start fighting for top five. Go keep the kids, the girls from down in New York City. So I think it was really monumental. And obviously, men's basketball gets way more attention, and that's understandable. We all know why, and it's just been, you know, one of the best programs in the country. But this championship run for the women is so much more impactful, even than what the Final Four did for the men. So it was a real thrill to watch.
No, I agree. And I think, you know, the women's style of play, especially for those who may be frustrated by the way Syracuse men's offense has kind of fallen off a cliff in recent years. If you want to watch, you know, some fun, some entertaining basketball that shows, you know, great ball movement and just an aggressive style, I mean, they're definitely one of the more entertaining teams to watch in women's college basketball. I think that they were a team that, you know, maybe without the early jitters, maybe without, you know, a little, I mean, obviously a size advantage for UConn, like, they weren't going to win that game, but there were some factors that were definitely in their favor, and those are factors that are going to continue, you know, past this. I mean, you saw it in the 16-0 run in the third quarter for the SU women's team, that this is a group that really knows how to fight, and that's something that's going to carry over. They're going to learn a lot from this. And it's not like the men's game either, where, you know, if you're not a traditional power, that you have to worry about your coach, you know, heading elsewhere. I think Q's in for the long haul. Syracuse has made a lot of investments in him, a lot of investments in the women's program of late. And now that it's paid the ultimate dividend, well, almost the ultimate dividend, you know, making the Final Four, getting to a national championship game, I think that, you know, you're only going to see this program grow a hell of a lot more. I am really looking forward to what happens next for them. And then, you know, you brought up, too, I'm looking forward to what happens next for UConn. Like, I hate UConn as an entity, but I can have respect for things they've done. You said I thought that the Bob Diaco hire wasn't a bad one in football. I think that, you know, Calhoun really did build a program out of almost nothing in the 90s. or at least without much history in the 90s. And I think that Gino Auriemma has been able to do stuff that you know, no coach has been able to do in any sport. He's been able to basically create a death machine. And where this year's team differed from, I think, previous teams is just how dominating and how just good. I mean, great is even an understatement. This team was, and it's a testament to how the women's game allows you to have, you know, 4-year starters and a culture of winning with similar players. It doesn't mean the men's game should go back to that or will ever go back to that. It's just a note that, you know, he's evolved the way the women's game thinks, the way it looks, and he's allowed women's basketball to progress a ton. I don't really think UConn is going to drop off, you know, much if at all, when he decides to hang it up. And I heard him on the Dan Patrick Show this morning, and he definitely seems like he's starting to look in that general direction in the you know, near future, I guess. But I mean, we'll have to see. I think, you know, other programs have shown themselves an ability to stop them, not in the last 4 years, but, you know, between the Notre Dames and the Stanfords and South Carolinas and Baylors, and there's plenty of other schools that have managed sustained success past what, you know, Syracuse has just done this year. But I think, you know, maybe 5-10 years down the road, I think we're starting to get to a point where, like, UConn happened to have a generational player in Breonna Stewart. Now that she's gone, it's going to be interesting to see next year if given how much the rest of the country has grown and grown while trying to catch them, it'll be interesting to see if we see our first real kind of parity-driven season in women's college basketball with maybe 10 to 15 teams even competing for the championship.
Yeah, as a Connecticut person, I will tell you that for probably the last 15 years, every time they have one of these generational players like Diana Taurasi or Maya Moore, and just from where I'm coming from, my dad is a ravenous UConn women's basketball fan. Like, it's his favorite team of any sport, of any league, of anything. So when Diana Taurasi was graduating, I said, you know, oh, they're definitely not going to be as good with Diana Taurasi. He's like, oh, no, trust me, they're bringing in a bunch of other players who are just as good. And then they brought in Maya Moore, and I said the same thing, and then they were just as good after she left. So I don't think they should be quite as good without Breonna Stewart, because she was, like, just a ridiculous talent, if that wasn't obvious by the four MOPs and four straight tournaments. But I'm kind of done questioning it, so we'll find out, I guess. Yeah, definitely some interesting points about kind of what they've done as a whole, as an athletic department. I've long held the belief that Jim Calhoun is the most important person in the University of Connecticut's history, because before the two basketball programs emerged, like, no one wanted to go to that school. It wasn't a great school. Now it's a pretty good, very good public university with a lot of very good students, and it didn't happen before they had a reason to go up and stay in stores for 4 years. So, yeah, that's all very important for them, and hopefully their women's basketball program will be nice enough to let some of us come and play and compete a little bit. But I wouldn't bet on it.
No, and I wouldn't either. I think that, you know, it takes a while for a program to really, you know, drop down, and I don't think that's going to happen either. But again, there's UConn was unbeatable this year. They were unbeatable last year, but that doesn't mean that they're invincible either. And that goes for any team that, you know, marches through a regular season unbeaten. They still, in many cases, do get tested in the playoffs. That there's, you know, at some point that the sample size allows you to find ways to game plan around it. Even if you don't win, you start to expose some holes. I mean, you saw it with elements of our game for a short amount of time. And I said it during that game that, like, you know, UConn didn't play its best basketball that day. They didn't, but Syracuse didn't either. And that's kind of why you ended up with a typical pedestrian score that many people will just forget, you know, by the time they listen to this, if not sooner. I think, you know, you can go to the NBA and see that the Warriors, like, while they're obviously playing a style of basketball that people can't replicate, can't necessarily defend because they don't have the same athletes or specifically Steph Curry, at the same time, you know, teams are starting to beat them at a more, I wouldn't say rapid because that's not the word, but a more frequent pace than they were before. And part of that is just the toll of an 82-game season and boredom with the regular season, as Draymond Green described today. But a lot of it, too, is that, you know, you finally have enough film that people can figure it out. And if a team with, you know, a couple very, very good players and zero shot at the playoffs, like the Timberwolves, can find a way to beat them, I do start to wonder, and you know, maybe stupidly so, you know, whether or not they're vulnerable against, you know, one of the better teams out west. Now that the blueprint's starting to get written more and more regularly, and to be honest, largely by subpar teams this season.
Yeah, it is weird that, I mean, the Celtics are pretty good despite not having a ton of talent. Brad Stevens is amazing, but it is interesting that they there's definitely like a motivation thing. Like, there's no reason they should be losing to the Lakers and the Timberwolves and blowing out everyone else. But I think Draymond was pretty candid yesterday when he kind of had his comments after the game. And it's understandable. People don't like to hear that. But, like, people like to take human nature out of sports and believe that everyone's like an automaton or, like, a video game where you just, you know, the players are the same every single time you play. But it's just not realistic. And the T-Wolves are super talented. Like, Carl Anthony Towns is a borderline all-star already. Andrew Wiggins is awesome. So it was surprising to see them just not put forth a great effort. But yeah, I think that's the difference between like the NBA and what we see with women's basketball. Like, just if UConn doesn't bring its A game, the other team still needs to play like a perfect game to beat them. If the Warriors don't bring their A game, I mean, an under 500 team can beat them. So I think that's like, but it goes back to that whole, like, are they good for the sport or not thing. I hate to like criticize a team for winning, and I don't necessarily subscribe to like them not being good for the sport, but they've just created such a talent gap that I also understand why people just believe everything's a foregone conclusion. And if, I mean, I probably would have had the game on if Syracuse wasn't playing last night. I don't know, I wouldn't have been watching it as intently, but I can totally get why people would think there's like a better use of their time that night versus. But then at the same time, if they weren't this undefeated powerhouse and it was two, you know, 28-5 teams playing in the title game, they probably would have lost a whole other segment of viewers. So I do think that's an interesting debate and a worthy one. But the difference between what UConn's done relative to the rest of their sport and what even a dominant team like the Warriors are doing, and they might have a chance, they still have a chance to win out and be the all-time winningest regular season team. It's monumental.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, I mean, I'm a noted Warriors hater just because of the fact that I hate Bay Area sports. But I don't think they're going to do it. I was regrettably convinced of it maybe 2 weeks ago, but I'm starting to see the cracks. They still have to face the Spurs. I mean, there's no shame. If you go 71-11 or 72-10, I mean, it's not like you earn some sort of, you know, awful place in history. I mean, unless you don't go win the title after that, but the Warriors will be fine. UConn basketball will be fine. And we'll all be fine watching, you know, whether or not. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if you have one dominant team, it might take a little while, but it does encourage, you know, others to chase after it. And some will chase after it and be copycats and do poorly, you know, trying to imitate. And others will chase after it in ways that they try to, you know, combat it head on and play a style that, you know, shuts it down. I think to me, I much prefer, you know, the latter, because I think that's how the game develops and grows and starts to. I mean, for the NBA, you know, it takes a long time for a seismic shift in play style. But it is interesting to see different styles of play pop up the way the Warriors has. In women's basketball, I think that I prefer to see people find ways to stop it instead of just copy it, because then what you're doing is you're taking a game that's still, you know, largely in its infancy and still growing a ton and developing a ton, and you're allowing it to quickly splinter off different, you know, ways of doing things. I mean, even a sport like college football that's, you know, 130 years old, you're still seeing, you know, there's 3 to 5 types of offenses still trotted out there. And to me, that's what makes that sport so much fun, is that, you know, there's so much more, you know, game playing that goes into the week to week. There's so much more, you know, experimentation that happens more frequently. And to me, that just, you know, that makes the game more watchable. It makes the game a lot more interesting, because there's that I mean, obviously with the, you know, expecting 18 to 22 year olds to do something is right away and intangible, you can't allow for in pros, but, you know, having 18 to 22 year olds then implement, you know, almost playing different games completely. If you want to look at some of the more innovative offenses or defenses, that's a hell of a lot of fun. And something that I'd like to see happen in women's basketball too.
For sure. And I was just looking. I didn't realize. I knew the Warriors had the two games with the Spurs. I didn't realize their other two were against the Grizzlies both times. That's not. Yeah. Like, why that? Why did that happen?
Go 69-13. Do it for me.
I think they'll fall just short. I don't think they're going to beat the Spurs twice. They might beat the Grizzlies twice, although that's pretty tough too. Not that the Grizzlies are great this year, but they're mean. And
knock them around.
They would be very happy to ruin the Warriors thing. So I think they fall. I think they probably split those four, honestly, the way they're playing now, and they fall a game short, which would be pretty unfortunate. But also, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Yeah, I mean, I have no animus towards the Warriors. So
right. I mean, at the end of the
I
day,
thought
I'm
it was
still, at the end of the day, I'm still a Knicks fan, so I had to take pride in something during my NBA seasons.
Rambus,
shh, please don't.
It's happening.
It's not. Please no.
I was on a bus ride to my apartment because our subway line was down last night, and I saw that, and they almost kicked me off. I think the way I responded to that article, which dropped at like 12:15 a.m. I don't know if I don't know if the Knicks like begged Mark Stein to run that so late, but it was a fun late night read.
Yeah, really, really.
Sorry, John.
it's fine. Just trade Melo and save him from this, please.
He was only 100 games under 500 in 2 years with the Timberwolves. So,
I mean, Melo doesn't deserve this.
No, I like Melo. I actually don't really dislike the Knicks. I just think they're comically tragic. My team's boring awful.
That's true. You guys were boring awful this year.
I don't know what I'd rather be.
And you gave all your picks to the team that's going to dominate the division next year.
Yep, you're welcome.
Hooray. All right, on that note, beer. Dan, what were you drinking to get yourself through the Syracuse games?
So after the loss to North Carolina, we went to Pony Bar, which is one of the better beer bars in the city. I had a Sculpin. They only had the regular Sculpin, and they had the Habanero, which I was not in the mood for, because I don't know that I'll be in the mood for it again. I've had it once. It was interesting. But I don't know that's a thing I'm going to like go out and look for at this point. But I had the regular Sculpin, which is good. I like the grapefruit more. I haven't had the pineapple yet. I don't know if it's made its way out here yet.
Soon.
But the regular ones, yeah. The regular one's really good, so no complaints. I had the Old Chub Nitro from Oster Blues. Not my favorite Oster Blues thing. Dark and full-bodied, decent, but, you know, I'm not a huge fan of, you know, I'm not a huge porter fan, or just, I don't know, those, like, coffee notes don't always agree with me. But it was pretty good. And I had an Obergangwit, which, again, one of my solid go-to, was always happy to find that, and it seems to be pretty easy to find now, which is always good. So, some pretty decent options down there on a Sunday night or Saturday night.
Yeah, I mean, Omega Gang's everywhere at this point. I think it's always good to see good beer find its way around the country. I know I can find it pretty regularly out here as well. So, yeah, definitely a positive. On my end, I was down in Houston, so enjoying some new things. Had the Carbach Hopadillo IPA. Had that a couple times. Had the St. Arnold Summer Pils, which was very good. I'm not usually a big Pilsner drinker, but this was very enjoyable. Had St. Arnold's Art Car IPA as well. Had to get myself a fresh glass of Yellow Rose from Lone Pint. I've discussed that one before. It's very, very good. Carbach also had the Weiss Versa Wheat. It's a wheat beer. Very, very, you know, just like over the top, but like in a good way. Banana notes on that one. I really enjoyed that. I thought I had gotten a good sign from getting a beer from Eighth Wonder Brewery called Dome Foam. Sadly, it was not the case. And beyond that, had your typical like Texas you know, local beer, Lone Star, which I don't know. I mean,
shout out to Matthew McConaughey.
I don't hate Lone Star beer, and like I see a lot of people pan it as like a shit beer. I don't like. It's not like I would go out and like try to drink it all the time, but when you're sitting around eating barbecue or just relaxing or whatever, like I don't really see the problem with it. Had Carbox Weekend Warrior as well, and that was a very good pale ale from them. I was going to head over to the brewery, but the way the day was going and all that on Sunday did not work out. A shame. Maybe next time I'm down in Houston, if ever, I'll have to hit them up.
Was the Dome Foam just a stale Labatt Blue Light?
You would think that that would sell a lot if they had really done their market research before Syracuse fans got there. But no, it was just your typical kind of okay cream ale. I don't really know why they went with Dome Foam out of some sort of weird coincidence. Maybe it's just, I'm sure there's a backstory there that I would like to know just for the hell of it.
Maybe the Astrodome? Is it a Houston beer?
Ah, yes. That could be it.
That's likely, I think.
It was weird when I was at the stadium seeing the Astrodome, like, just chilling in the parking lot. Because, like, it's still there. But I don't think it's used for anything.
I don't think they've used it for a couple years.
But, like, I don't really know why it's there.
Well, I think it's, like, it might be protected. It might be a, I don't know if it's, like, a historical monument now or something. But
such a waste of parking lot space. I mean, I get it. And I think that the stadium is important. But I think it was just crazy to, like, see, like, how much of the parking lot that thing takes up. You know, like, and then right next to the enormous NRG Field.
Yeah, apparently it was closed in 2008 after code violations. And since then, only maintenance workers and security guards have been allowed to enter. And they were considering fixing it up for the 2012 Summer Olympics. So that didn't happen. So it sounds like nothing's really happening with it now.
I'm just surprised Houston tried to bid on the 2012 Olympics.
Yeah. Houston doesn't seem like an Olympic city to me.
No. I mean, you know what? I actually think Houston gets a bad rap. They actually seem like a really nice, accommodating city. It was a lot of fun. People were nice. Like, I actually enjoyed myself quite a bit there. I thought that my only complaint was that I'd say that the downtown bar and restaurant scene was better. I think the beer scene was pretty good. But the only complaint, and that this goes for a lot of cities, not just Houston, is the fact that you need to take a bus to get from, you know, the fan events and everything else, if you're staying in downtown, to get over to the stadium. I just think that's a result of kind of modern stadium trends and urban planning trends, though. Indianapolis happens to have their stadium right in downtown, and everything's kind of connected via surface streets, or they have their, like, overhead skyway that connects a bunch of the hotels and the convention centers and the stadiums, and that's pretty cool, and I think that's kind of unique to them. That's something that I did wish was the case this year when I had to, you know, sit in an hour's worth of traffic from downtown Houston to the stadium, or then deal with an hour's worth of traffic on the way back after the game when every single person was also trying to leave.
Yeah, it is weird. Just like, I mean, Dallas 10 has the same thing where Arlington's how far away. And like you said, like most other cities try to build all their stuff in one area, which makes all the sense.
Well, the problem with Dallas is, since it is a metroplex, there's like, since it's, they purposely put all the crap everywhere. So like, there's all the stuff in Dallas for part of the fan events. They usually have some fan events, and a lot of the broadcast stuff gets set up in Sundance Square over in Fort Worth. And then the stadium, you know, is actually in Arlington. In this case, the stadium's in Houston. So it's just insane that it takes, I mean, I live in California. I understand how traffic works. It's just insane that it takes, you know, an hour in Houston. I much more understand it when you're driving from Fort Worth to Arlington or Dallas to Arlington, and how spread out that metroplex is.
Yep. I guess all these places, like, I don't know about Indy, but, like, Atlanta also is obviously a horrid traffic city. So I guess they just like picking cities with ridiculous traffic situations.
Yeah, I would think, though, that, like, I think this is why New Orleans works so well, usually, because, I mean, the stadium's in New Orleans proper. I'm pretty sure you can get there fairly easily from all the usual touristy stuff. Yeah, that's not the case in most other stadiums in the country now, just based on, again, the way they've done things and how much land you need for an NFL stadium in particular. It's just not really conducive to having it in the middle of a city. I mean, that's why the West Side Stadium didn't work for the Jets. That's why, you know, the Rams are building, you know, not downtown, not near Hollywood, not, you know, near the beach. They're going to build in Inglewood. So yeah, it's going to be interesting because obviously, you know, the Rams are probably, their stadium will probably end up with a Final Four sooner rather than later. And so a lot of these other new stadiums. So it'll be interesting to see how, if and how, you know, the Final Four and other big events keep moving further and further toward stadiums that don't necessarily, you know, make it easy to get around. I mean, I doubt they ever repeat the you know, MetLife Stadium disaster again when it comes to the Giants and Jets home in New Jersey. Just because, I mean, unless you're going to host the Super Bowl in New Jersey and not New York, it just doesn't work. But yeah, I think people have proven they'll go to these games regardless. So I don't really see it changing anytime soon.
No, I mean, they're definitely not going to move them out of the big stadiums. And honestly, I was talking about this today as someone who's been to a Final Four now, and you've been to a couple. The sight lines are not great. Everyone knows that. I will say, if people want to move these games back to, like, basketball arenas, you can prepare for absolutely no actual fans to be able to go based on the coaching convention being the same weekend and all of the families and all of the media. So while, you know, fans don't get, you know, great seats at all, they're not, I in Atlanta at least, I didn't think they were quite as bad as I expected. And also, it's not the most expensive sporting, like, major sporting event championship. Yeah, I mean, I was working not even full-time, right at, like, a year out of college, and I was able, and it wasn't easy, but I scrounged up enough money to get myself to Atlanta and tickets to the game. And we ended up selling the championship, which helped. But, like, if you really want to go, it's, you know, you'll pay a couple hundred bucks for the whole book, unless it's, like, a ridiculous set of teams. So while you're not going to be able to, you know, you're not going to be sitting in, like, the MSG fourth tier where you still see everything pretty easily, like, the seats, at least at the Georgia Dome, and I'm sure it's pretty similar to most of the other ones, are all roughly the same size. They're not as bad as people make them out to be, and otherwise you'd be paying, you know, $3,000 to get in the door at Wells Fargo or something. So I think for what it is, I think you kind of get the best of what the options are, because otherwise it'd just be a totally corporate exclusive event that would suck. So that's my rant on the seating situation at the Final Four.
No, that's fine. And honestly, I think, you know, if you win the geographic lottery the way UNC and Villanova fans did this past Monday, I mean, you were looking at a situation where, like, I had two sets of seats, and I sold one pair for $100 apiece for the Monday night game, and it was third level midcourt. And I mean, that's a great view, and it's something that, like, you know, if this was the NBA Finals, would be worth a couple thousand. Yeah, it's because Villanova fans weren't really going to be able to flock down there very quickly from most of their outposts in New York. I know that, you know, North Carolina fans, a bunch of them had definitely made plans to just be there for the championship because they assumed a lot about beating us, from what I understood. And UNC definitely increased. But, you know, it's also an older fan base, so I understand that there might be a little bit difference when it comes to travel. Like, I mean, you see UNC fans, there's a lot of all the same criticisms levied on parts of our fan base about being older and more, like, kind of sedentary and very much, like, old-fashioned. That exists in by three to fourfold with UNC. They have plenty of young fans, too, obviously, but plenty of older ones as well, and you saw them out in full force. It's a the Monday event because of that, and because, you know, especially when you play the lottery of, you know, geography versus, you know, who's going to get there and all that. I'd say it was definitely much more corporate on Monday than the very, very fan-centric event on Saturday when I was there. And definitely a lot less Syracuse fans there come Monday night as well. I can understand why. I mean, you don't want to take off a day and all that. But definitely two very different crowds. I would highly recommend, you know, if you can afford it, you can find a way to get there in some way, shape, or form. Everyone should go to one, especially if their team's there, just because it puts a new perspective on, you know, just how much goes into these events and how much, you know, I guess like fanfare and fun and like how much a lot of these people, like we're not the only ones that care this much about our teams. It's great to see. I mean, I saw probably 45 to 50 different, you know, t-shirts and hats for different teams while we were just like walking into the stadiums. It was fun to see, you know, people, even if their team wasn't there. I mean, I saw, you know, far reached schools as like small as South Dakota State, you know, represented in the line of people trying to get in. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you had kind of a similar experience. I mean, 2013, we obviously lost the first game, which was like within 4 hours of us landing in the city. And I think we paid like $350 for our sets of tickets each, and we sold the championship for just over $200. So we ended up spending maybe like $150 to go to the Final Four of the Saturday games net. And I mean, we lost real early, obviously, like we did on this weekend. But it sounds like you kind of had a similar experience where just being there for the weekend was a blast, even after losing. Just getting to see like that whole world of college basketball culture, and then obviously you had two pretty interesting fan bases down there in UNC and Villanova. After, and I guess Oklahoma was probably an interesting one as well, just based on them being kind of a football school.
They weren't there very long, is the problem.
They're probably close enough where they could all peace out.
Yeah, they all drove, and then none of them got there until Saturday. So then they were all gone that night or early next morning.
Yeah, that makes sense. What would you say the full breakdown on Saturday was like, in terms of like the fan breakdown?
I'd say before I got over to the stadium, I would have thought that all four were pretty even. But once you got there, Oklahoma was number one by a significant margin. I'd say
that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd say UNC was a close two. It was not a close two. I'd say UNC was two, and Syracuse was actually a close three.
Like it seemed like we were really well represented.
We were incredibly well represented. I think I was talking to somebody about this today at work. It's largely because, you know, all the West Coast alums like myself were able to go. We have a pretty large contingent of alums in Texas that all kind of drove there. We have a decent amount in New Orleans. There's a lot of folks who can get to these games, you know, when you're in Texas. And I think all of them just decided to, or at least a ton of them decided to just go. Because I met a couple different SU fans from California. So yeah, I'd say we were pretty close third. At one point I thought we were in second. But once you saw the building fill up a little bit more, definitely a little more powder blue. Then Nova was fourth. I wouldn't say like, you know, lapped, but at the same time, I'd say like they weren't close to where us and UNC were. And then Monday, I'd say the stadium was probably, I'd say it was a slight edge to UNC, but not by much. Nova like doubled in size from the time.
It seems like Nova fans just like got themselves there. Like from everything I heard from people that were down there, like just apparently every flight in Philadelphia got redirected to Houston, and every Nova fan just went to Houston Sunday night or whatever.
Yeah, my hotel, I thought it was like pretty evenly mixed the first two nights, and then by Sunday, I thought I was in a Nova hotel. It was pretty wild, and you even saw like the student section. If they showed you know, an overhead shot or two during the games on Saturday, you saw that Nova probably had between them and us probably had like the least amount of fans in there. And then, you know, Nova had more fans in the student section for the championship game than North Carolina did. I just thought it was like completely wild how many folks got down there. And, you know, again, UNC had plenty of people there themselves, but that was probably, I'd say in order of fan bases, it was one, corporate, two, Nova, well, two, North Carolina, a very close three, Villanova, and then four was probably Syracuse, because I think Oklahoma fans just ran.
Yeah, so take this for all the bigwigs of the NCAA who obviously raid the selection committee process every year. Invite Syracuse. They will come to things, no matter where they are, because our fan base does not stay in Syracuse when they graduate, much to the chagrin of the Central New York economy. We go everywhere else.
Very true. It was interesting to see because, like, you know, I was at the college football playoff this year, and it was interesting to see, you know, the interplay with college basketball fans versus college football fans. And like, obviously, you and I are both, but hold more, I guess, in common demographically with college basketball fans, just in terms of where we live and you know, where we went to school and things like that. It was interesting to see. There was a lot more shit talking than you saw when you had two Southern fan bases of fairly successful programs, Alabama in particular. There was a lot more drinking going on than there was the college football playoff. Despite the fact that the college football playoff, you weren't just relegated to booze before the game and after it. You had access to it during as well, because that event's run by college football playoff and not NCAA. But yeah, it was definitely interesting to see a little bit different vibe from the crowd, and especially when it was only a couple months after I just went to the other event, to be able to, you know, quickly kind of do that Venn diagram of, you know, what's completely different and what holds true for both.
Yeah, I think the Nova fan base is probably not all that dissimilar. It's probably a little less diverse, but it's probably not all that dissimilar to the Syracuse fan base in being like a lot of Northeasterners, obviously a private school, very basketball focused. And you get that brash, like everyone else is also probably a bigger pro sports fan outside of their college allegiance. So you get like just that awful like Philly NFL Eagle fan type deal going on. And then you also had like them just riding this wave of they just beat Oklahoma by 1,000. So I'm sure North Carolina fans didn't quite know how to deal with that.
Well, I mean, you look at North Carolina fans, they really didn't take too kindly to us, and most of the other ACC schools really didn't take too kindly to us, and we show up and start, you know, prattling on about how good we are and when we win games, and even if we don't, we kind of have some smack to talk to people. I don't know how well Southern fans, just in general, like, take to that. Granted, I think UNC UNC will talk more than most, just because I think they have plenty of Southern fans, they have plenty of fans in Northeast, they got plenty of fans in D.C., you got plenty of fans elsewhere. You wrote the one point, though, comparing us to Villanova a little bit. I think the one thing that we had that Villanova might not, I don't know how much, I feel like Villanova's local fan base is much smaller than ours. I would assume that their casual fan base might be a little bit smaller than ours, too. I think that, you know, in New York, there's a lot more fans, obviously, than there are in Philly. And I think, you know, between Long Island and the city itself and even, you know, Westchester and most of upstate, I think there's just a lot of casual Syracuse fans in the city. There's a lot of casual UConn fans, a lot of casual Syracuse fans that had no affiliation to the university or the city. So I would bet that Syracuse is a little bit different in that regard, especially, again, to the local fans. I mean, Philly has, you know, five teams to choose from, and Villanova doesn't necessarily play in the city versus some of the others that do. So I would be interested to see kind of the way we're different than them. I mean, obviously it doesn't really matter in terms of wins and losses. It's just more of I guess the anthropological study, if we're gonna go deep into it.
Yeah, I think that's what I meant a little, like, in terms of like fan base diversity, where I'm assuming most Nova fans have like a direct connection to Villanova. I don't know if you heard, but Ryan Archidiakono's parents went there. I don't know if you heard that because you were at the game, but we heard it a lot, those of us that weren't at the game. But yeah, like you said, if you're a Philly, you adopt like a Drexler, a Temple, or a Nova. But Syracuse obviously has like the huge local fan base, and obviously it's very well documented how segmented the Syracuse, like all the various corners of the Syracuse fan base between the alumni and the locals and whatnot, where Nova's probably more alumni and family and whatnot, and probably smaller. Also interesting that I think Nova probably had this crazy turnout because they don't go. I mean, they went in what, 2009 to the Final Four, but they really, even though they've been really good for a while, barring the recent tournament flameouts, like they really don't get counted among the like second, third tier like just below the Blue Bloods like we do, even though now they have one more title than us, which I hope not to hear too much about in the next couple months. But so this was definitely like a big moment for them, I think. And it'll be interesting to see what Jay Wright does with it, because I don't expect him to change his like recruiting philosophies too much, because he's kind of ran that same four out one in system like the whole time he's been there, and it's been pretty effective. But I do wonder if he's able to get in with like a slightly higher caliber of guard now.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't doubt that. I mean, Villanova's always kind of recruited the same types of players, and it's worked fairly well. So definitely will be intriguing to see what they can do, especially in the zombie Big East. You know, I was going to say, and you brought up the fact they have two titles. I feel like none of the teams with two titles get the consideration we do with one, if that makes sense. I mean, you're looking at, I don't have the full list in front of me, but NC State, Villanova, Florida, USF, obviously, but that's so far in the past that it doesn't matter.
San Francisco for the people who don't remember, Will Chamberlain. Bill Russell. Sorry. I mean, I think it's because like a lot of those were like kind of not fluky. Well, some of them kind of fluky. But also, I think Syracuse is just so consistent.
Well, most basketball fans now just assume that Syracuse is going to be good because it's all they've known at this point.
Yeah, where Nova's had down periods, they've had they had a 13-win year a couple years ago. So like Syracuse. Again, this, our Final Four team, was our losingest team under Jim Boeheim, which it's still crazy. The first Jim Boeheim team to lose 14 games. In one of our worst years, we went to the Final Four. So that's kind of what, Syracuse will be around. Even if they don't make a deep run every year, they'll be in the tournament, 90% of the time, and they'll usually, someone will usually be like, oh, Syracuse to be dangerous is a 4 seed there, a 5 seed there. Like, this year was weird just because they were such a low seed and they had so many losses. Because usually it's just, we're always there in the conversations, floating around somewhere in the top 25.
Weird. Maybe we are a blue blood.
Maybe. I wouldn't say we are, but we're
light blue blood.
We're there. We're somewhere. We're somewhere below. For some reason, if the fan base wants to be mad, is UConn, because they don't get counted, and they definitely should be. Not to give UConn all the, I don't know why this turned into the UConn credit podcast, but
yeah, weird.
UConn probably should be a blue blood, and they just don't get the Dukes and Kansas is just don't want any part of that.
I'll put UConn on the same tier as us.
how nice of you.
It's just such a backhanded
UConn with your four titles. You could be second tier program. Yeah. We'll be nice.
Yeah, I think it's us. It's them. It's Michigan State. It's
Louisville.
Georgetown, I guess, but I think it's getting harder and harder to defend that at this point. I'd almost put Villanova in front of them now.
Oh, I would. Villanova's way better on an annual basis than Georgetown. Georgetown since 2007 hasn't done anything.
Well, JT3 is trash. Let's be real.
Oh yeah, I mean, eventually they kind of have to get rid of him, right? They should be better. They're in DC, but they won't. Jeez. John Thompson's scary.
Yeah, he's terrible.
John Thompson will say, I'll go beat up the chancellor, and he will do it because he's crazy. And JT3 will just be coach there forever, which is fine with me. I accept it. I hope he stays there forever.
Well, the problem is, I would much prefer that Maryland and Georgetown come undone on a yearly basis. But the issue is now, UVA can go in and get the players that those two programs used to get all the time. Maryland, just like they did in football, invited the rest of the Big Ten into their turf. And that could have implications for us, too, because I think the one place, other than Philly and New York, obviously, where we've always been able to go down and get guys is that kind of, DMV corridor. So it'll be interesting to see long-term if we get shut out of that area because there's a glut of programs mining that for talent.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that, but you're right. Philly and DMV have probably been the two best. It's even New York City, we haven't gotten that many NYC kids in the last couple of years. We've actually gotten more out of Boston.
Yeah, definitely a weird construct. I'm very much looking forward to these next couple of years, as I always am when it comes to Syracuse sports.
Yeah, and if all falls well, you could be looking at a top 10 team next year. So Please come back, Malachi. Not that we're telling you what to do with your future.
I am far from telling him what to do. I'm just telling him, what I would I'd like him to do, but I don't implore him to do so. It's just something that I would appreciate.
Yes, and none of you should tell him either. Just let him figure it out.
Especially on Twitter. Don't do that.
Oh, yeah. Don't tweet at him. He's clearly, you don't want to make him upset. Just leave him alone. He'll figure it out.
I mean, it's unlikely he'll impact him at all, but at the same time, let's not risk it. Just don't annoy the guy.
Right.
And on that note, don't tweet at teenagers. That was Dan. I'm John. You've been listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. Dan, thank you as always for joining.
Yes, happy to be speaking basketball into April.
Yeah,
very fun. Let's do it again next year. Let's go to Phoenix, as I said in multiple social media posts.
I would also say let's go to Phoenix since I can drive there.
I probably won't drive there because that'd be crazy, but I'll fly there.
Perfect. Or fly here and we'll drive there. That way,
that'd be fine.
It'll probably cost you less money to do that.
Yes, I'll plan for this now. And Malachi, don't make me refund my plane ticket.
Agreed. All right, that was Dan. I'm John. Be sure to rate, review, subscribe on Blog Talk and iTunes. And we'll see you next week. Go Orange Lacrosse.
Go Orange.